Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 608, update on the Oklahoma City bombing, in search of John Doe number 2. This has been recorded on September 2nd of the year 2007. I've done a number of broadcasts, quite a few broadcasts actually, dealing in one way or another with the Oklahoma City bombing. There was far more to that crime than what we have been told. We're going to explore an interesting, it's not exactly a side light to that crime, but an interesting aspect that we have not talked about before, and that is the death, the highly suspicious death in prison of a guy named Kenny Trentadue, and I may not be pronouncing his last name correctly. It's spelled Trentadue. He was a former bank robber who bore a strong physical resemblance to the composite sketch of John Doe number 2, and he was imprisoned for parole violations and then died under very strange circumstances. Appears to have been beaten to death. Exactly who did it and their possible motives for doing it are what we're going to explore in this broadcast. Due to the limitations of time, the many international connections of the Oklahoma City bombing, including evidentiary tributaries running between the Oklahoma City bombing and the first World Trade Center attack, September 11th, and the AMIA bombing in Argentina, are things that I will note in the description for the broadcast. Again, please utilize the descriptions for these programs and the other material available on the Remarkable Spitfire website. If you're only listening to the programs themselves, you're missing the greater part of the For the Record experience at this stage of the game. We're going to plunge right into an article by James Ridgway from the July-August issue of Mother Jones, July-August of 2007 issue of Mother Jones magazine. This article is called In Search of John Doe Number 2, The Story the Feds Never Told About the Oklahoma City Bombing. It reads in part as follows. Kenny Trentadue was driving a 1986 Chevy pickup when he was pulled over at the Mexican border on his way home to San Diego on June 10, 1995. He was dark-haired, 5 feet 8 inches and well-muscled, a former athlete who had picked up construction work after he quit robbing banks. His left forearm bore a dragon tattoo. Highway patrol officers ran his license and found that it had been suspended and that he was wanted for parole violations. After 2 months in jail in San Diego, Trentadue was shipped on August 18th to a prison in Oklahoma City for a hearing on the parole violations. The move placed Kenny in close proximity to the most famous federal prisoner in America. In one way or another, it also sealed his fate. 4 months earlier, another car had been stopped by a state trooper some 80 miles north of Oklahoma City. It was 10:20 a.m. on April 19, 1995, and much of the country was still waking up to the enormity of what had happened earlier that morning when an explosives-laden Ryder truck gutted the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, killing 168 people. The driver of the 1977 Mercury Marquis was arrested for carrying a concealed weapon and driving without tags. He gave his name as Timothy McVeigh. 2 days later, McVeigh was identified as the John Doe number one wanted in the bombing, and fellow anti-government extremist Terry Nichols turned himself in to the police. They were indicted on August 10th, and federal authorities said they had their men, but there were many who didn't buy the tidy closure. A sprawling Great Plains town known for its tornadoes, Oklahoma City was already the center of a swirl of theories about the crime, all of them insisting that the two men could not have acted alone. Some refused to give up on the idea of Middle Eastern terrorists speculating about a plot headed by Saddam Hussein. Others suspected an inside job by the feds. Some simply stuck to the far more plausible conviction that there were co-conspirators not yet apprehended. After all, immediately following the bombing, law enforcement had been searching furiously for a man whom numerous sources said they saw with McVeigh, and who by some accounts was seen walking away from the Ryder truck, the character whose police composite sketch became known around the world as John Doe Number 2. According to the police description, this man was about 5 feet 9, muscular and dark-haired. By some accounts, he drove an older model pickup truck and a dragon tattooed on his left forearm. Kenny's brother, Jesse Trentadue, knew nothing about the resemblance between his brother and the nation's most wanted man, but he now believes it sparked the events that would launch him on a 12-year investigation of a prison mystery and a massive government stonewalling effort. In the process, he would discover documents showing that even as the Justice Department was working to convict what it insisted were only two conspirators, its agents were actively investigating a wider plot, a plot whose possible ramifications they concealed from defense lawyers and from a public that at a delicate moment in an election year they were anxious to reassure. The government's refusal to disclose what it knew and what it did not know may also have forestalled the nation's best opportunity to address the problems in federal law enforcement and intelligence that would become tragically apparent on September 11, 2001. And what's not mentioned here are the evidentiary tributaries between 9/11, the first World Trade Center attack, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the AMIA bombing in Argentina. You can read about those, by the way, and among other program descriptions, the description for the Record 456. Skipping down. Released on parole in 1988, Kenny Trentadue cleaned up, started working in construction again, and got married. His first child, a boy named Vito, was born 9 days after Kenny was arrested at the border. On August 19, 1995, Kenny called Jesse's house to report that he had just arrived at the Oklahoma City Federal Transfer Center. Jesse's wife, Rita, an attorney and law professor, was surprised he'd been shipped from San Diego all the way to Oklahoma for a probation hearing. Kenny told her, in a conversation that was, like all inmates' calls, "It's that jet age stuff." Kenny called again that night, sounding chipper, and the brothers strategized about the parole hearing. Kenny promised to call again the next day, but no call came until the early morning of August 21st when the phone rang at Kenny and Jesse's mother's house. It was the prison warden. Kenny, she said, had committed suicide that night. She offered to have the body cremated at government expense, a move without precedent in federal prison policies, but Wilma Trentadue turned her down. 5 days later, Kenny's body arrived at a mortuary in California. There were bruises all over it, clumsily disguised with heavy makeup, slashes on his throat, ligature marks, and ruptures on his scalp. Photos of the injuries were included in a letter that Jesse drew up on August 30th and hand-delivered to the Bureau of Prisons, which is part of the U.S. Department of Justice. Quote, "I have enclosed as Exhibit A a photograph of Kenneth's body at the funeral," it read. "This is how you return my brother to us. My brother had been so badly beaten that I personally saw several mourners leave the viewing to vomit in the parking lot. Anyone seeing my brother's battered body with his bruised and lacerated forehead, throat cut, and blue-black knuckles would not have concluded that his death was either easy or a, quote, suicide," unquote. After describing Kenny's injuries in detail and speculating how they might have come about, bruises to his arms from being gripped, others to his legs from being knocked to the ground with batons, slashes to his throat from someone possibly left-handed, which Kenny was not. Jesse concluded, "Had my brother been less of a man, your guards would have been able to kill him without inflicting so much injury to his body. Had that occurred, Kenny's family would forever have been guilt-ridden, with the pain of thinking that Kenneth took his own life and that we had somehow failed him. By making the fight he did for his life, Ken has saved us that pain, and God bless him for having done so." 2 days later, on September 1st, the Bureau of Prisons issued a press release stating that Kenny's death had been, quote, "ruled a suicide by asphyxiation," unquote, and that the injuries on the body, again quoting, "would indicate persistent attempts to cause himself injury or death," unquote. Officials would later put forth an elaborate scenario in which Kenny tried to hang himself but fell, bruising his head and body, and then tried to slit his throat with a toothpaste tube before he succeeded in his second hanging attempt. In fact, as the Bureau of Prisons would have known, no official ruling as to the manner of death had been made. Rather, every communication from the state medical examiner's office indicated it was being treated as a suspicious death. On August 22nd, the day after the body was delivered to the medical examiner's office, Chief Investigator Kevin Rowland called the local FBI office to file a complaint. On a form documenting the call, the FBI agent wrote "murder" and noted that Rowland, quote, "believes that foul play is suspected in this matter." The state's chief medical examiner, Fred Jordan, refused to classify the case as suicide, listing the manner of death as "unknown, pending investigation." As was customary with suspicious deaths, within days the Bureau of Prisons formed a board of inquiry. In an unusual move, the staff attorney heading the probe was told to treat his team's finding as, quote, "attorney work product," unquote, which would protect it from discovery in any future lawsuit as well as from Freedom of Information Act requests. In October, the Bureau of Prisons General Counsel issued a memo noting that, quote, "there is a great likelihood of a lawsuit by the family of the inmate," unquote. To this day, the Bureau of Prisons, FBI, and Department of Justice refuse to discuss the case. Spokespeople for each agency referred questions for this story to an FBI official in Oklahoma City who declined to comment, citing ongoing litigation. Not long after Kenny died, Jesse got an anonymous phone call. Quote, "Look," the caller said, again quoting, "your brother was murdered by the FBI. There was an interrogation that went wrong. He fit a profile," unquote. The caller mentioned bank robbers but didn't give many details. Jesse didn't know what to make of the tip. He put the call out of his mind. Exactly what happened the night Kenny died is impossible to reconstruct, in large part because a great deal of evidence went missing or was destroyed by prison officials. According to Bureau of Prisons documents, a guard discovered Kenny hanging from a bedsheet noose in his cell at 3:02 in the morning of August 21, 1995. Stuart A. Lee, the official in charge at the prison that night, refused to unlock the cell while he waited for a video camera to film the body. According to a Bureau of Prisons memo, he would later tell investigators that he knew Kenny was dead and he thus, quote, "was not concerned with taking any immediate emergency action," unquote. The prison medic on several occasions said he performed CPR on Kenny, but later admitted he made no effort at resuscitation. The video of the body was never made, or it was erased, depending on whose account you believe. Prison officials did take photos of Kenny's body, though when the family asked for copies, they said they couldn't find them. The photos reappeared in the FBI's files years later. Kenny's clothes vanished between the time he was found hanging in his cell and the time his body was turned over to the medical examiner. Other evidence, including his bedsheets, boxers, and fingernail clippings, disappeared for several weeks. Investigator Roland would later suggest they had been in the trunk of an agent's car. Kenny's cell was cleaned by 2 p.m. the day of his death before legally required examinations of the site had been made. And even though the medical examiner's office had been given orders to preserve the cell, the walls, including a pencil scrawl that prison officials called Kenny's suicide note, unquote, were painted over, leaving only photos whose lack of detail, unquote, according to the FBI crime lab, rendered it doubtful if this handprinting will ever be identified with the handprinting of a known individual, unquote. Other key evidence was simply omitted from or buried in the official reports. FBI and State Bureau of Investigations officials later testified in a lawsuit brought by the Trentadue family that a second person's blood had been found in Kenny's cell and that there were no cut marks on the noose from which he was, according to prison officials, cut down, unquote. According to an internal FBI memo, a prison guard told his neighbor that Kenny had been killed and then hung in his cell as a cover-up. An inmate who reported hearing similar statements from a second guard said he was warned to keep silent and then sent to isolation. Another inmate, Alden Gillis Baker, would later give Jesse's lawyer a note describing an incident during which, he said, Kenny got into an altercation with a guard. Eventually, he wrote, additional officers entered the cell where there was, quote, a lot of physical violence going on, unquote. He heard faint moaning, unquote, and later heard the sound of bedsheets being torn. He would repeat this account in a deposition in connection with a lawsuit brought by Jesse, but a judge ruled that Baker, a convicted robber and sex offender, was not a reliable witness. In 2000, Baker was found hanging in his cell in a California federal prison. Government accounts of the incident relied heavily on reports from a different set of inmates. One claimed that during his 2 days at the prison, Kenny had seemed angry and agitated. Another claimed he was acting upset, paranoid, and weird in general, unquote, and thought everyone was talking about him having AIDS. The Bureau of Prisons transcript of Kenny's conversation with Jesse's wife reads, "It's that AIDS stuff," unquote, not, as Rita insists he said, "that jet age stuff," unquote. According to medical records, Kenny was HIV negative. And then there were the words scrawled in pencil on the wall, quote, "my mind's no longer its friend," unquote, and "love ya, familia," unquote. Oddly, the Bureau of Prisons investigator who took the pictures shortly after Kenny's death wrote in a caption that the scrawl read, quote, "love, Paul," unquote. The FBI agent who investigated the case immediately following Kenny's death did not even look at the cell. He did visit the prison, but spoke only with officials, interviewing no inmates and collecting no evidence except for the photos of the cell. The case languished for months until complaints from the medical examiner's office reached the Department of Justice in Washington. In early 1996, the department's Civil Rights Division took over supervising the investigation and decided that the case should be presented to a federal grand jury, which would determine whether to issue an indictment. On July 6, 1996, more than 10 months after Kenny's death, the grand jury was convened. Justice officials from Washington went to the trouble of commuting to Oklahoma City to oversee the proceedings. It was an election year, and President Clinton's Attorney General Janet Reno, still under a cloud for her handling of the Waco siege 3 years earlier, was preparing to try McVeigh and Nichols. The last thing the Department of Justice needed was a trial in Oklahoma City, accusing its employees of murder and obstruction of justice. But to put the case to rest, federal officials would have to find a way around Fred Jordan, the Oklahoma chief medical examiner who had refused to classify Kenny's death as a suicide. Within a few months, the local FBI office was calling Jordan, a man with a long and distinguished career who had achieved near-heroic status in Oklahoma City for his effective and sensitive handling of the bombing victims' remains, a, quote, loose cannon, unquote. In December of 1995, Jordan told an FBI official that the Bureau had urged him to hold off on releasing an autopsy report until the FBI could complete its investigation. He also told the U.S. Attorney's Office in Oklahoma City, according to correspondence from that office, that Kenny had been, quote, abused and tortured, unquote. Later, he would tell them, according to a Bureau of Prisons lawyer, that the federal grand jury is part of a cover-up, unquote. In a memo to his own files, Jordan wrote that it was, quote, very likely that this man, parenthetically Kenny Trentadue, was killed, unquote. In search of a second opinion, Department of Justice officials asked Bill Gormley, a forensic pathologist at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, to review the case. In May of 1997, Gormley called Kevin Rowland, the chief investigator for the Oklahoma City Medical Examiner's Office, who wrote a memo to his files noting that Gormley, quote, was troubled that the Department of Justice only seemed interested in him saying that it might be possible these injuries were self-inflicted, unquote. In fact, Rowland wrote, Gormley had grown convinced that, quote, this man, again parenthetically, Kenny Trentadue, was murdered, unquote. As late as July of 1997, Fred Jordan told a local TV station, I think it's very likely Kenny was murdered. I'm not able to prove it. You see a body covered with blood, removed from the room as Mr. Trentadue was, soaked in blood, covered with bruises, and you try to gain access to the scene, and the government of the United States says, no, you can't. At that point, we have no crime scene, so there are still questions about the death of Kenny Trentadue that will never be answered because of the actions of the U.S. government. Whether those actions were intentional, whether they were incompetence, I don't know. It was botched, or worse, it was planned, unquote. After more than a year of proceedings in August of 1997, the grand jury, which, like all such panels, had heard only evidence selected by the government, concluded its investigation without issuing any criminal indictments. The Department of Justice held back the news for 2 months while staff in Washington met to devise a rollout plan that a Department of Justice aide compared to, quote, coordinating the invasion of Normandy, unquote. The plan targeted the media as well as Senators Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, and Brian Dorgan, Democrat of North Dakota, who, thanks to Jesse Trentadue's efforts, had taken an interest in the case. In a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing a few months earlier, Senator Hatch had quizzed then-Attorney General Janet Reno about Kenny and told her that, quote, it looks like someone in the Bureau of Prisons or having relations with the Bureau of Prisons murdered the man, unquote. But Hatch never followed through on his stated intent to hold hearings on the case. Neither did Oklahoma Republican Senator Don Nichols, then the majority whip. In December of 97, Nichols held a press conference lambasting the Fed's handling of the case. He said prison officials in Oklahoma had told him they'd been ordered not to talk about it. The next day, Nichols got a visit from Thomas Kuker, K-U-K-E-R, head of the FBI's Oklahoma City office. According to an internal FBI memo, Kuker assured the senator that he, too, had been concerned about the case but had become convinced there was no foul play. After a second meeting with the FBI 2 months later, Nichols backed off. The Department of Justice also continued to pressure medical examiner Fred Jordan to the point where Oklahoma Assistant Attorney General Patrick Crawley wrote to a Justice Department attorney that the Bureau of Prisons and FBI had, quote, prevented the medical examiner from conducting a thorough and complete investigation into the death, destroyed evidence, and otherwise harassed and harangued Dr. Jordan and his staff. The absurdity of this situation is that your clients outwardly represent law enforcement or at least some arm of licit government. It appears that your clients and perhaps others within the Department of Justice have been abusing the powers of their respective offices. If this is true, all Americans should be very frightened of your clients and the Department of Justice. 4 months later, in July of 1998, Jordan suddenly changed his conclusion on Kenny's manner of death from unknown, unquote, to suicide, unquote, saying he had been convinced in large part by the identification of the supposed suicide note by a handwriting expert, even though the expert had not been able to see the actual note and had received what the Department of Justice itself considered inadequate samples of Kenny's handwriting. Although he never fully retreated from this determination, Jordan would later say in a deposition that he still believed Kenny was beaten and that he himself had been, quote, harassed by the Department of Justice from the very beginning, unquote, of the case. The last government investigation into the death of Kenny Trentadue, conducted by the Department of Justice's Office of the Inspector General, was concluded in November of 1999. The report was sealed and only a brief summary made public. The full report, a copy of which was obtained by Mother Jones, ran to 372 pages and included names and many other crucial details. It also contained material taken from the secret grand jury proceeding, according to its cover page. The Office of Inspector General report supported the government's position that Kenny's injuries had been self-inflicted, but it did find fault with the prison's response and with the FBI's investigations, concluding that Bureau of Prisons and FBI employees had lied about their actions to supervisors, investigators, and the Office of the Inspector General itself. In 2003, Jesse filed a complaint about what he considered shoddy investigative work in the report with the President's Council on Efficiency and Integrity, a White House agency. The council dismissed the complaint, and when Jesse asked why, it sent him 55 pages of evidence the Office of the Inspector General had submitted. All but 350 words had been blacked out. In late 2000, the civil lawsuit brought by the Trentadue family commenced in federal district court in Oklahoma City. The jury found that Stuart A. Lee, the prison official in charge the night Kenny died, had violated Kenny's civil rights by being, quote, deliberately indifferent to his medical needs, unquote. 4 months later, the court awarded the family $1.1 million for emotional distress, based not on Kenny's death itself, but on the Bureau of Prisons' conduct afterward. The court denounced prison employees for trying to cover up their own misconduct, declaring that, from the time of Trentadue's death up to and including the trial, these witnesses seemed unable to comprehend the importance of a truthful answer, unquote. The government appealed, and the matter remains bogged down in the courts to this day. For Jesse, the ruling was bittersweet. After more than 4 years, he'd been investigating the case, interviewing witnesses, filing Freedom of Information Act requests, lobbying lawmakers, but he was no closer to understanding why Kenny might have been, as the medical examiner had put it, tortured, unquote, or why the prison and the Department of Justice would have gone to such lengths to cover up what occurred. By the spring of 2003, Jesse Trentadue had all but given up on solving the mystery. Then he got a call from a small-town newspaper reporter in Oklahoma whose name was J.D. Cash, and he wanted to talk about Kenny, whose story and photo had been widely circulated on the Internet. What kind of vehicle had he been driving when he was stopped at the border? Did he have tattoos? Then Cash explained what had gotten him interested. Kenny's particulars fit the police descriptions of John Doe No. 2, and some photos of Kenny bore a clear resemblance to the police sketch of the alleged bomber. And both Kenny and John Doe No. 2 looked quite a bit like another man, a bank robber named Richard Lee Guthrie. Guthrie's name meant nothing to Jesse Trentadue, but in the far-right radical scene, he had some notoriety. In 1994 and 5, Guthrie and his gang, the Aryan Republican Army, carried out an impressive series of 22 bank robberies across the Midwest, netting some $250,000 that they used to support the white supremacist movement. The Aryan Republican Army had a flair for the dramatic. They rented getaway cars in the names of major FBI officials. At some robberies, they wore Clinton and Nixon masks. At others, they tried to look like Arabs. At a December 1994 robbery, they wore Santa and Elf streets. The following April, they left behind an Easter basket holding a bronzed pipe bomb. In a home movie, Guthrie's partner, Peter Langan, donned a black balaclava and talked about the coming white revolution. The ARA's philosophy was old-fashioned nativism, but their style was a takeoff on the Irish Republican Army with Latin American Revolution and rock and roll thrown in. Members of the Philadelphia skinhead music scene were part of the group. Langan liked to call himself Commander Pedro, unquote. Outside the gang, he cross-dressed and later, when sentenced to prison for the robberies, requested that a judge authorize a sex change operation. Cash told Jesse that some people, including some in federal law enforcement, thought that the ARA might have been involved in the Oklahoma City bombing and that Guthrie could have been John Doe number two. Guthrie, along with other key ARA members, was finally arrested in January of 96 and was reported to be cooperating with federal prosecutors tracking the far right. That July, shortly before he was due to testify in court against Langan, Guthrie was found hanging in his cell. A lot of that going on in this investigation, no? J.D. Cash, who died in May at the age of 55, was an unsettling figure, a genuine crusader for truth, as well as an instinctive self-promoter. And it goes on to discuss J.D. Cash's investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing and a number of evidentiary tributaries running in various directions. I've talked at great length about the Oklahoma City bombing in numerous programs. One of the interesting aspects of the Oklahoma City bombing concerns also the physical resemblance of a fellow named Andreas Strassmeyer to John Doe number two. And in the written description for this broadcast, I hope to be able to have from the internet some comparisons of photos of Strassmeyer with the composite sketch of John Doe number two. Strassmeyer was a former German Army intelligence agent who was the security director at Elohim City, a white supremacist compound at which McVeigh resided for a period of time, according to Carol Howe, an FBI and ATF informant who passed a lie detector test. It was actually Andreas Strassmeyer who planned the Oklahoma City bombing, and McVeigh was basically his protege. I would note in this regard that there were bulletins out for Andreas Strassmeyer shortly after the crime. Andreas Strassmeyer, however, was not only a German citizen, but he also was the son of Helmut Kohl's former chief of staff, Gunter Strassmeyer. And Gunter Strassmeyer was also the architect of the German reunification. And Andreas Strassmeyer's his grandfather had been one of the founders of the NSDAP, the German Nazi Party under Hitler. And of the many, many aspects of the Oklahoma City bombing that have been covered up, certainly the Andreas Strassmeyer connection is one of them. And among the many reasons, the many complex and mundane reasons, had Andreas Strassmeyer been convicted of the Oklahoma City bombing, he would have gotten a death penalty, and they do not have the death penalty in Europe, and they don't like it. And this would have been the death penalty administered to the son of a key German politician at a time when Germany was deemed to be an essential ally of the United States for prosecuting various forms of foreign policy and national security policy. And again, there were State Department memos urging that Strassmeyer not be apprehended, because obviously that would have created serious problems at Foggy Bottom. More about this, however, in the description of the program. This entire article will be available for people to read in the FTR supplemental section, one of many aspects of the Spitfire website people should utilize. However, that is all we have time for right now. This concludes For the Record program number 608, update on the Oklahoma City bombing, the search for John Doe number two. This has been recorded on September 2nd of the year 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.